Hey friends, this episode of The Fellow on Call is not meant to be used for medical advice and is intended for educational purposes only. Patient information has been modified to ensure privacy. The views expressed in this episode do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers. Enjoy!
Welcome to another episode of The Fellow on Call, the HemOnc podcast. We're coming at you from Relo University Medical Center. I'm Bronak.
I'm Vivek.
And I'm Dan.
And in today's episode, we're starting a new series, this time talking about colorectal cancer. I know a lot of people have been asking about this one for a while. It's been something that's been in the works for a while, and I'm super excited that we're finally here. A big topic of discussion, even in the news just recently, and I'm excited to get into all the data with y'all.
Yeah, and today we're going to break this down in our series. We're going to have a lot of guests, but today we're really going to focus on the basics and really work up, why do we have these high-risk features? The idea of lymph nodes, perinatal invasion, all that stuff, staging, how we think about MSI testing, all these really critically important concepts, and walk you through a historical perspective behind it. So you're going to see different episodes for colon and rectal separately in a localized setting, and we'll have our metastatic discussions, pharmacists, surgeons, really excited for this one.
Yeah, you know, I'm happy we're finally addressing colorectal cancer and colon cancer in this one as well. It does feel a little bit like standing at the base of a very, very steep trail and looking at the top and being like, oh, we have a lot of ground to cover, but it's going to be good.
But you know, every time you climb that mountain or go up that trail, Dan, it's so much nicer at the top, right? So I can't wait to get through another big series, and hopefully our listeners enjoy it along the way. All right, guys. Well, so without further ado, let's roll that first episode of our colorectal series. All right, so I'm amped to be starting another series. It's been a little while since we've recorded. And so I'm just curious, you know, with the summer coming up around the corner, what's everybody doing? Any big trips planned?
We've got a trip planned to Portugal for our wedding anniversary. I know, Rodak, you'll tell our listeners about your trip that you have planned, which is, honestly, I'm very jealous of your trip. So I won't steal your thunder there. But going to Portugal, what I'm most excited about, though, is getting in my car and driving to the movie theater on opening night for Monkey Man. That movie is going to be amazing. It's Indian John Wick, Dev Patel. Super excited for it. I've been waiting for an Indian John Wick my whole life.
Yeah, that sounds pretty sweet. I'm definitely looking forward to seeing that one too. Yeah, I'm going to Italy in September. Nothing over the summer. A lot of service weeks coming up, but yeah, super excited for Italy.
So listeners, as a backstory, in case you're new to our show, you'll remember that Vivek and I got married the exact same weekend. So we have almost the exact same anniversary, which means that our annual trips always seem to line up at the same time. So he's going to Portugal. I won't tell your wife that you're more excited about the movie than your trip with her, but she'll find out when this episode airs.
Keep it on the deal.
But my wife and I are going to Japan for 2 weeks at the end of April into May. So we're super, super excited. It's been on our bucket list for a really long time, and we were just fortunate enough to be able to have the time off to be able to do that. So I think we're hitting like 5 or 6 cities, doing a lot of good eating, a lot of sightseeing, some nature time, some city time. It's going to be a little bit of everything. It's going to be a good way to close out my fellowship journey as well. I'm super excited. But for now, guys, I think until we get to that point, I think we should shift our attention to the next thing ahead of us, which is this new series that we're starting on colorectal cancer. And as we've been doing with a lot of our episodes, we are going to kick things off first with a general introduction to colorectal cancer. And then from there, we'll start building with a series of guests on this series, going through each of these diseases in great detail in subsequent episodes. So why don't we kick off our first episode of the colorectal series with a case.
All right, so I've got a case for us. We have a 48-year-old male who presents to the medical oncology clinic for evaluation of a newly diagnosed colon adenocarcinoma, so a young guy. He underwent routine screening colonoscopy and underwent biopsy of an ulcerated cecal mass. Pathology was consistent for colon adenocarcinoma that had proficient MMR by IHC and was microsatellite stable by PCR testing. Staging imaging showed no evidence of metastatic disease. The preoperative CEA was 10. He then underwent a right hemicolectomy with removal of regional lymph nodes. Final pathology revealed a well-differentiated colon adenocarcinoma and no nodal involvement. He wants to know about his stage and prognosis and is very anxious to hear about the next steps. And as many of our listeners know, we definitely need more information from that PATH report. But before we get to that, let's back up to the time point after his colonoscopy. First, can we just go through some fastbacks about colorectal cancer?
So if you're listening to this podcast, you probably already know that colorectal cancer is very common. It's the third most common cancer diagnosed, so by new cases as of the latest data this year. And in terms of cancer-related deaths, it's in the top five of cancer-related deaths for both men and women. So very, very common and sort of a high-impact cancer to know about. We're not going to get too much into screening right now, but briefly, screening colonoscopy is recommended for all adults at the age of 45 in the United States. Those are the 2024, those are the current recommendations. We'll discuss this recommendation and alternatives, including FIT, sigmoidoscopy, stool DNA, serum circulating tumor DNA, sort of all the screening options. We'll have a future episode on that. The other thing to know is that colon cancer incidence is on the rise in young adults. It's the leading cause of death for men under the age of 50 and the second leading cause of death for women under the age of 50. There's actually just an article in New York Times last month about the increasing incidence of people even in their 20s and 30s. So there's definitely something that's going to be coming up in primary care clinics sort of across the country going forward as well. And one of the most important things to know is that the treatment for colon cancer and rectal cancer are very different. Even though it kind of just anatomically looks like one connected tube, these are biologically different diseases, and their treatment is very different in the localized setting. In the metastatic setting, we kind of treat them the same. But for early stage, these are essentially two very different diseases.
The reasoning for this increasing incidence in young patients is still under active investigation, and there's really a great deal of work to understand the genomics of colorectal cancer in the young adult population. But back to our case, so we had a patient under 50 with colon cancer found on a screening colonoscopy. How do we appropriately stage these patients preoperatively, and what's the deal with the CEA? We always talk about getting a CEA.
So yeah, Vivek, that's a super important question, especially because in order to make the right treatment decisions for our patients, we need to make sure, especially in that first visit, that we have all the critical information that we need. So all patients need to undergo a staging CT of their chest, abdomen, and pelvis in order to rule out metastatic disease. And this is because one of the most important advances in colorectal cancer is definitive treatment for limited metastatic disease, sometimes called oligometastatic disease, with the option of curative surgical resection followed by adjuvant chemotherapy. And this early identification of synchronous metastatic disease is critical to curing this disease in our patients. The other important thing to remember is that there is a recommendation to obtain an MRI of the abdomen to better characterize liver lesions. So historically, patients were often deemed not to have synchronous metastatic disease with indeterminate liver lesions and potentially had worse disease-free survival and overall survival, probably because we missed patients that had evidence of metastatic disease. These patients may have undergone a surgical resection and then were later found to have metachronous metastatic disease, which means the appearance of metastatic disease after the time of adjuvant chemotherapy treatment. Essentially, to say it another way, patients didn't get proper imaging done, and so we may have missed small evidence of disease that we couldn't pick up on a CT scan. And therefore, these patients had worse outcomes, mainly because we were treating them like somebody that had more localized disease or not as many sites of metastatic disease as someone that may have had more evidence of disease. So the MRI just wasn't widely available in the past, which greatly affects how we think about what is appropriate staging based on older studies done in like the late 2000s, for instance. In some cases, in the surveillance setting, a PET CT can also be helpful to identify patients with low burden, isolated metastatic disease. For instance, in a patient that has a rising CEA, but otherwise the PET really doesn't have a lot of utility in that upfront setting. You specifically asked about the CEA, and we hear about the CEA being used all the time. And always remember, as general internal medicine fact, right? Labs are suggestive and we use them with the overall clinical picture. So you have to take the CEA with a grain of salt. But it is an important prognostic marker preoperatively, and it's also helpful to detect asymptomatic recurrence in surveillance after definitive treatment. So CEA stands for carcinoembryonic antigen, and two Canadian scientists Phil Gold and Samuel Friedman discovered CEA in 1965 after testing adult and fetal tissues to attempt to identify tumor-specific antigens in the GI tract and in pancreatic cancer. And so what they discovered was that the CEA was commonly expressed in these malignant tumors derived from the epithelium of the GI tract in cancer. And this same antigen was found in fetal gut, liver, and the pancreas between 2 and 6 months gestation. So it was called carcinoembryonic antigen, given that it was found in the tumor and normal embryonic tissue. And the thought was that this antigen is repressed during normal cell differentiation in the GI tract, but may reappear in malignant cells due to abnormal cell maturation. And so this discovery led to our modern standard of care, which is to use the CEA in surveillance to detect asymptomatic metastatic recurrence, which can be treated with curative intent. So it really did change the paradigm of how we approach this disease.
It's always really interesting to see how these things were discovered. They were literally just looking at random antigens and found this one that was common to both tissues, which is very, very fascinating. And we also know for the cancer of unknown origin that an elevated CEA might tip your hat to think maybe this is something that might be colorectal in origin, things like that. So that's another place where it can be useful. So for this patient, he had an elevated CEA preoperatively. Does this influence our treatment at all? And what's the prognostic significance of this?
The short answer is that it doesn't really change management up front. It can tell you, okay, this could be a useful marker going forward for this patient. We know that their disease produces CEA, and still post-operative surveillance with CEA really is the key thing here. There have been a few retrospective studies looking at the prognostic significance of preoperative CEA elevations. One representative study was actually published in around 2010, so almost 15 years ago now, in Korea. This was a single center study looking at 474 patients who had preoperative CEAs drawn between 1999 and 2008. At that time, elevated CEA was defined as greater than 5. That's a standard definition, and it was significantly associated with worse disease-free survival and overall survival in patients with stage 2 disease, but not with stage 3. We're going to go through this soon, but basically stage 2 does not have any nodal involvement. Stage 3 has nodal involvement. So although it was found that this was prognostic, it has not been used as a predictive tool to stratify patients to either receive adjuvant chemotherapy or not to receive adjuvant chemotherapy. Just because it portends a worse prognosis, it doesn't mean that it predicts benefit for chemotherapy. And it also makes you wonder if these patients with stage 2 and elevated CEA were just improperly staged. Maybe they didn't have a complete lymph node assessment or adequate staging imaging. That's going to be a key theme to keep in mind as we go through historic data. Again, just like Ronik mentioned before, MRI not widely available previously. We weren't as good at finding small metastatic lesions that were present at the time of initial diagnosis in some of this older data.
Yeah, it's really important to keep that in our heads as we talk about some of this, particularly in our next episode when we really get into the details of adjuvant therapy. So obviously, the most important thing is to accurately stage our patients with imaging prior to curative intent surgery. And this patient had an elevated preoperative CEA, which doesn't mean all that much other than maybe it has some prognostic significance. But this patient's also young. And as we discussed, the rates of colon cancer are on the rise in these younger patients. What's the role of genetic testing? And why should all patients undergo testing for MSI high status in colorectal cancer?
So in short, our listeners need to remember that every patient with colorectal cancer, especially under the age of 50, should meet with a genetic counselor to discuss germline testing. And all patients with colorectal cancer should get either MSI high testing by PCR or mismatch repair status by IHC. Now, I do have a question, though, because we see those words MSI high testing and mismatch repair testing all the time. But I think it's time that we actually define these terms. I don't think anyone's ever told me what they actually mean. And so, Vivek, what do these terms mean and how come they can be used interchangeably?
So I think this is really important to understand. So what is a microsatellite? We all have microsatellites. Every human has microsatellites. And they're repeating sequences of DNA that consist of a short motif of nucleotides repeated several times. So for example, you might have anywhere from 1 to 6 base pairs long. It might be CA, 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 repeated a length of number of times. These are found throughout the genome, and they're highly variable among individuals. They can be encoding regions of DNA or non-coding regions of DNA. And these areas exhibit a high mutation rate because there's so many replications of repeats. And this leads to genetic diversity, and it leads to some of these polymorphisms that you hear about whenever you think about science nowadays. You always hear about that genetic polymorphism. And this is one of the ways that we get some of these polymorphisms. It also helps, you know, things like paternal testing and things like that, right? These are really important things that lead to genetic diversity. Because there are such high mutation rates, which can often be mismatched nucleotides as these repeating sequences are being created, we have repair proteins to fix major mutations that could lead to the development of malignancy. So that's why these mismatch repair proteins are essential for these regions. And these mismatch repair proteins are MSH2, MSH6, MLH1, and PMS2. So normally, each individual has a consistent length of these microsatellite repeat sequences, and their mismatch repair proteins keep everything normal. They kind of keep everything in steady state and in check. But if there's a germline loss or an acquired loss of the mismatch repair proteins, one of the four that I mentioned, there will be more mutations that accumulate, which can lead to a malignancy. So remember that germline loss of MSH2, MSH6, MLH1, or PMS2, that's when we think about hereditary Lynch syndrome, those endometrial cancer, ovarian cancer, colon cancer, those patients that have that hereditary syndrome. And the subsequent tumor that develops because of the loss of mismatch repair proteins, and now we have a bunch of mutations, that means that tumor is going to have a lot of abnormal neoantigens expressed that can be identified by the immune system. So it basically means that your tumor is just setting itself up to be killed by the immune system because it expresses so many neoantigens that can be recognized by your immune system to kill. So that's why it's really important to identify these patients who have changes to their microsatellite areas. So can one of you go through why it's called microsatellite instability and how we test for this, as well as just simply testing for mismatch repair protein deficiency?
Yeah, there's a great paper about this in JCO in 2010. We'll have a link to that in our show notes. Testing for mismatch repair deficiency is just easier to understand. It's a little more straightforward because you're just looking to see, are these tumor cells expressing certain proteins, these mismatch repair proteins? So we can do an IHC for MSH2 and MSH6, which sort of help to recognize DNA mismatches, and MLH1 and PMS2, which function as a part of the complex that repairs those mismatches. And if there's an absence of staining, then we call those MMR deficient. And MMR deficient tumors, about 98% of the time, that correlates with MSI high on MSI testing. But it is a separate test. And so we'll talk about that. If there's positive staining for all four proteins, so if IHC identifies that there's normal amounts of MSH2, MSH6, MLH1, PMS2, we call that MMR proficient. MSI testing is PCR based. And this is where we're comparing the length of microsatellites found in a patient's normal tissues versus the microsatellites in their tumor tissues. So we're looking to see, are the lengths of those microsatellites unstable? Is there instability in the length of the microsatellites in tumor tissue when we compare it to the length of those same microsatellite regions in their normal tissue? Basically, the way we do this is we use primers for common microsatellite regions, and you look for a discrepancy between the lengths. Early on, though, we didn't really have a standardization as to which primers to use for this testing, and that led to pretty variable quality in the testing. And so there was a conference held by the National Cancer Institute back in the late 90s, in 1998, to promote consistency with the standard 5-primer test. If 40% of the primers, so 2 out of the 5 primers, showed variable lengths compared with patient's native DNA, it was deemed MSI high. If fewer than 40% of the primers showed different lengths, it was called MSI low. And if all the primers were the same, then it was deemed microsatellite stable. Ultimately, we figured out that MSI low and microsatellite stable kind of behaved the same way. And it was MSI high that was more biologically significant. It was concordant with loss of mismatch repair proteins and higher mutational burden. So really, this MSI high is a proxy for high mutation burden in the tumor. Testing at this point has improved significantly. And so you'll often see this reported, MSI status, reported on next generation sequencing panels. But I think understanding that fundamental concept is super important.
So just to clarify all this one more time, because this is counterintuitive to me. I don't know why. Basically, you're saying if there's more mutations, it's a better thing because the body is more able to recognize the mutations and therefore is going to be more successful in helping to work synergistically with whatever we're doing to eliminate the disease. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, and you know, like you said, it is counterintuitive, right? Because you think of a high mutation burden as meaning the cell is really abnormal, so maybe it's going to behave really aggressively. And while that may be the case some of the time, what we definitely know is that because these cells are more abnormal and expressing more neoantigens, the body is more easily able to tell that from normal tissue. And so it makes it a little bit easier for the immune system to help out when it comes to cancer treatment.
I'm embarrassed to admit that until thinking about it like this, I was sort of blindly just memorizing these things and I didn't truly grasp the correlation. I think going through and explaining why the tests are the way that they are actually makes this seem a lot more approachable than I previously thought. So sorry, I don't mean to get us off track, but I thought that was really, really interesting. And hopefully other people found that to be a helpful discussion as well.
So back to our patient. Why should all patients younger than 50 undergo germline testing? That's something that was a little bit confusing to me because like if they're MMR proficient, then why undergo germline testing? And why do all patients with colorectal cancer need MSI by PCR or MMR by IHC? Like what's the evidence base for doing this?
There are two really important studies to answer your question. So the first one, there's a pivotal study published in JAMA Oncology in 2017 that showed the prevalence of germline mutations for younger patients with colon cancer. And we'll link that to our show notes. So this study looked at patients from 51 hospitals in Ohio, is this Ohio Colorectal Cancer Prevention Initiative from 2013 to 2016. There were 450 patients younger than 50 included, and all of these patients underwent germline testing for 25 cancer susceptibility genes and MMR IHC testing. Interestingly, 16% of the patients were found to have a germline mutation, and 10% were found to be MMR deficient. So of the patients so there were 16% of the total cohort that were found to have a germline mutation. Well, how many of those patients should have been screened by current guideline consensus at the time? And we would have missed a third of those patients. And that's why it's recommended, because there's a significant number you're leaving on the table there. 16% of younger patients will have this germline mutation. So testing all of them makes sense, especially when we're going to miss a third of them, right? So this is where the recommendation that all patients under the age of 50 should be referred for genetic counseling to consider germline testing. So that was that study. We'll link it to our show notes. The other interesting thing there, 10% of patients had MMR deficient tumor, so highly prevalent. And that's really important because, like Dan said, it allows your immune system to recognize the tumor. And if we give chemo, we blunt the immune system. We found in stage 2 colon cancer, 5-FU-based adjuvant chemotherapy actually leads to worse outcomes because we're blunting the immune system. And in the future, we'll see adjuvant options of immunotherapy. So it's critical to identify these patients. There was another study done at MSK looking at the prevalence of MSI-high tumors across a variety of cancers, regardless of age. And this was published in JCO in 2018. They included 15,000 patients, and this encompassed 50 cancer types from 2014 to 2017. So a massive study, really, really important information. MSI status was determined by a computational algorithm called MSI Sensor, which is pretty interesting. It compared reads at designated microsatellite regions in tumor and normal tissue pairs. So just really comparing the lengths of those microsatellite regions and saying how many of those discrepancies exist. It wasn't just using 5 primers. So a lot more sophisticated and a lot probably more accurate, really, and more precise. So the most common tumors that were MSI high were small bowel, colorectal, and endometrial, which makes sense given Lynch syndrome and those tumor types. Over 800 patients had colorectal cancer in the cohort, and 15% of those patients were found to be MSI high. So what we know now is that of all patients with colorectal cancer, somewhere between 10 to 15% of those patients will be MSI high. So all patients should undergo MSI high status testing for their tumors regardless. And that should be really done on the biopsy taken at the time of the colonoscopy. It doesn't need to just be done at the time of surgery because it has significant implications. And we'll talk a little bit more about that next week as we go through even concepts of neoadjuvant treatment for some patients.
So in our case, our patient underwent MMR testing on the biopsy after the colonoscopy, just as Vivek said. And This did in fact show intact expression of MSH2, MSH6, MLH1, and PMS2, which are those genes that Dan mentioned moments ago. Regardless of this testing, he should be referred for germline testing, and we referred him to our genetic counselor after this discussion in the clinic. So we still need to tell him about his stage. So this is critical, and as we know, staging can be kind of confusing, but what are the critical components for the TNM staging when it comes to colorectal cancer?
So I'll start off by saying that in colorectal cancer in particular, I think that it's really important to know the breakdown, the individual components of the stage, that TNM staging. Many of us in the oncology world have heard the phrase that some stage 2 colon cancers are worse than stage 3. And so that comes down to what the actual components of the TNM stage are. So starting off, in colorectal cancer, T stage is based on depth of invasion rather than the absolute tumor size. Remember, in diseases like lung cancer, we were talking about, how many centimeters is the tumor. That's not the case for colon. So T2 is invasion into the muscularis, into the muscle layer of the colon wall. T3 is extension through the muscle and into the pericolorectal tissue. T4A is invasion of the visceral peritoneum, and that includes perforation of the bowel. And T4B is invasion of adjacent organs or structures like the abdominal wall or bladder. What matters is invasion through the muscle and not just into the muscle, unlike bladder cancer. That's kind of what differentiates the T2 from T3. And it also matters that T4B is invasion of an adjacent organs and other structures, as opposed to T4A, which is just into the peritoneum. So those are sort of the really important thresholds. And anytime we're at T3 or above, we're at stage 2, assuming that there's no lymph node involvement. So that's the T staging. End stage, that's based on the number of nodes found after resection. And so an adequate surgical resection means that you've examined at least 12 lymph nodes. N1 is fewer than 4 lymph nodes involved. N2 is 4 or more lymph nodes involved. And that's it. That's all you need to know. If you have any N other than 0, the patient is stage 3, regardless of T stage, and needs adjuvant chemotherapy. Adjuvant chemotherapy is indicated for these stage 3 patients. So how did we end up with a TNM system where stage 2 can be worse than stage 3? This seems a little bit crazy. Are you able to go into some of the history of that, Vivek?
So the evidence behind this concept, and I feel like I saw this on every lecture slide or any talk that I saw about colon cancer, comes from a JCO publication by Gunderson and colleagues in 2009. And they looked at the SEER database from older data, 1992 to 2004, and included nearly 110,000 patients with colorectal cancer. And what they did was they said, let's break things down, like Dan said, by the individual T and N components rather than just stage, and let's see how these people do. And interestingly, what they found was, these are just various combinations of T and N. They found that T4B N0, meaning I invaded to adjacent structures, the thing that Dan said is really important, had a 5-year overall survival that was similar to patients who had T3 N2 disease, meaning they simply just went through the muscularis layer, so that's T3, and they had 4 or more lymph nodes. And that had the same prognosis as somebody with no lymph nodes, which seems kind of crazy, right? It seems like, how is this thing possible? This seems nuts that those two patients are behaving the same. You know, that just doesn't make too much sense. And this is the idea where some stage 2s are worse than stage 3s, but there's a big issue when you think about this. And when you think about it, these patients, again, we're talking an older cohort, 92 to 2004, they were likely misclassified in their staging. When you think about it, we said that you need 12 nodes examined. That was one of the things that's really important at resection. You need 12 or more nodes examined. Only half of these patients had 12 or more nodes examined. Most of them had 7 nodes, 8 nodes, or even less than 7 nodes examined. So you may have had true nodal disease that you included as T4BN0. So you're making them look worse than they actually are because you misclassified them. And then, like we talked about, the preoperative staging was very different. So when we think about adjuvant treatment, this is why for even those high-risk stage 2s, Many GI oncologists argue to defer adjuvant chemotherapy and to really have an individualized patient discussion, which we'll get into next week. But it's not that you, just because you have these high risk factors that you take it with for 100% fact. There's severe limitations here, right? Based on the time era this was enrolled and likely stage migration, that you misstage these patients and that you have more higher stages that are misclassified as lower stages. And that really brings down the survival for those patients. But we mentioned some of these important risk factors to stratify patients. Ronak, what are the other important risk factors to stratify patients prognostically on the PATH report?
Like we discussed before, less than 12 lymph nodes examined puts the patients at high risk, so we may have misclassified them, and we could be withholding adjuvant therapy that would actually be beneficial to these patients. Essentially, all fit patients who have nodal disease need adjuvant chemotherapy, which was established in the 90s, is still true today in 2024. So in addition to having less than 12 lymph nodes be a high-risk feature, other features include the disease being poorly differentiated histology, if there's perineural or vascular invasion, if there's obstruction or perforation at the time of surgical resection, and any one of these criteria that we just discussed are thought to identify patients at a higher risk for disease relapse, regardless of their nodal involvement. And it's super important when you meet your patient for the very first time to go through that pathology report and go through the history of how the patient presented and evaluate to make sure that they meet these criteria, specifically looking to make sure the pathologist will comment whether there were adequate nodes evaluated. Super, super, super important as you're going through the information. Again, just to make sure that we're properly staging our patients and we're doing the best thing for them. So let's say that our patient ended up having invasion through the muscularis into the pericolorectal tissue, but there was no nodal involvement with 13 nodes examined. So based on what we discussed with our TNM staging, this would put the person at a T3N0 stage 2 disease. He notably did have perineural invasion that was noted on the PATH report, but none of the other high risk factors. So given that risk factor, he is considered a high risk stage 2 disease. We'll get into the paradigm for adjuvant therapy next week, but can we go through how these risk factors were developed to frame that discussion?
I think this is really important as we end the episode today. Ronak mentioned those risk factors, the less than 12 lymph nodes, perineural vascular invasion, obstruction, perforation at the time of surgery, poorly differentiated histology. And these were determined based on studies, retrospective studies conducted from the 90s to the 2010 time period. There is a key adjuvant chemotherapy trial that was published in about 2009 that even included these risk factors as a pre-specified subgroup analysis. So you can tell that these risk factors were identified in the 90s, right? Before the modern era of staging, we talked about stage migration, that we probably misclassified some of these patients. And the big question is, in the modern era, surgical techniques have improved. We are rarely getting reports with less than 12 lymph nodes examined. Things have gotten way better, significantly better. So are we really saying that these patients require chemotherapy just because they had bad prognostic factors in the 90s? That's a big question that's really unanswered. And that's why you'll see a lot of controversy here. The other big thing, we didn't routinely test MSI high status. We know 15% of patients have MSI high tumors based on the studies we mentioned before. So if you're saying that these are high risk patients, they have a worse prognosis, we should give them chemo, maybe you're harming them if they're MSI high, for example. Maybe these aren't the best end-all be-all characteristics. We should rethink. Are these the right characteristics we should be taking forward in the modern era of therapies? And right now, when you have these patients in clinic, know that if you just use these high risk factors alone, that there's a chance you're over-treating patients with chemotherapy if you're saying, well, they're a high risk stage 2 based on these risk factors identified in the 90s when we probably didn't have appropriate staging. So we have stage migration where they were misclassified. And when they looked like they were lower stages with high risk factors, they may have just been stage 3 anyway, and you would have given them chemotherapy anyway, which was the standard of care even developed in the 90s was chemotherapy in stage 3 disease, which means nodes. So basically, when we think about it, stage 3 disease, that means you have nodes, you need chemo. Stage 2 disease, that means you don't have nodes. And today, many people say you don't need chemo regardless of these risk factors. And the other last thing is, although they're prognostic, meaning that, okay, if you present with a bowel obstruction at the time of diagnosis, that's a bad prognostic feature. The question we don't know in a randomized study Is that predictive? Is having that risk factor predictive of having benefit from chemotherapy? We don't know that. And the benefits from chemotherapy tend to be on a slim range in the stage two patients. And we'll talk about that in the next episode. So know that these risk factors were developed not in the modern era. There are limitations with stage migration, with misclassifying patients. And the idea of stage migration is really important as you think about any of these studies in cancer when looking at how prognosis has improved and looking at prognostic risk stratifications that were developed in an era that doesn't reflect modern staging techniques, which is really highlighted for this example.
Well, that's awesome. I think that this is a really, really fantastic introduction to colorectal cancer. And I hope that listeners will go back, listen to this again one more time, take a look at our show notes, especially ensuring that you have all the information that you need before making any treatment decisions for patients is so critical to make sure that we're doing all the right things for them. So that includes, remember, looking at whether or not they've had adequate imaging. So remembering that CT scan, possibly also considering an MRI. Remember that PET scans don't really have a lot of value in that upfront setting. Using markers like CEA, especially in the surveillance portion of the patient's treatment, to see, you know, could they be having evidence of asymptomatic disease, rather. Taking the time to go through the information and classifying them based on the TNM staging for colorectal cancer. And trying to also identify whether or not your patient has any of those high-risk features, because that is going to be somebody that you're going to want to be a little bit more careful with when it comes to picking their treatment. And then the big thing that we also wanted to highlight from today, remember the importance of mutational analysis and also germline testing, especially for your younger patients. You will see as we go through this series, especially in that metastatic setting, has really, really, really important implications for treatment options for our patients and something that we want to be doing in the upfront setting. So guys, any final thoughts that you have before we wrap up today's episode?
No, I thought that was great. And just take a look at the show notes. Remember that this is a very essential things to understand while you're treating these patients. Don't just take everything with memorization and assume you can apply it to every patient.
And remember that this is why you had to go through all those lessons in molecular biology in med school. It is important.
Great reminder, Dan. Thanks for bringing back the flashbacks of biochem. All right, guys. Well, I think that wraps up another fantastic episode of The Fellow on Call. Until next time, we'll see you later.
See you later.
Peace.